It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
After 19 years in the big leagues, 40-year-old Billy Chappell has trudged to the mound over 4,000 innings. But tonight, he's pitching against time. He's pitching against the future, against age, against endings. Tonight, he will make the fateful walk to the loneliest spot in the world, the pitching mound at Yankee Stadium, to push the sun back up in the sky and give us one more day of summer.
Universal Pictures presents
like to be kissed.
How does this work, Billy? Little boys buy cards with your picture on them.
They buy those for the gum.
For love of the game.
So are you my mom's boyfriend?
I'm not sure.
But you've slept with her.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? And I guess I'm going to start off today's episode by saying play ball. Of course, now, by the time you hear this episode, baseball season will be in swing. But right now, we are in spring training. I had the draft for my fantasy league last night, and I drafted a team that probably will stink this year. But it is my pleasure each year that for, I don't know, the last 5 years or so to have had John and Maggie on to discuss a baseball movie each time the season is upon us. And they are back with us, John and Maggie Schaefer-Hames. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having us back.
At the start of what is going to be for me a very conflicting baseball season.
Well, for your purposes, I did draft, Nestor Cortez, who is now on your team. And, my thought process is that the Milwaukee team has pretty good success in getting pitchers to rise to a higher level than they had previously. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping he'll end up being a little bit of a surprise this year.
Yeah, just don't put him in the playoffs.
We don't want to do that because we're friends and I don't want you. So we, as always, we have Mr. Sean Whalen with us here today.
It is a pleasure to be here as always.
It's a pleasure to have you. And making his debut on the baseball show is my Pittsburgh Pirate Texas Ranger friend, Mr. Jeffrey Vaughn.
Good morning, everybody.
So everybody in the call is a baseball fan, and I think everybody enjoys a good baseball movie. Now, I'm going to say today we're doing For Love of the Game, which was John's request. And I saw this in 1999 when it came out, and I have to tell you, much like last year when you had requested The Natural, the first time I saw this movie, I didn't like it. I thought it was boring. I thought it didn't have really enough baseball in it. And I walked away saying, this is not a good movie. I have not watched it since 1999, but watched it this week for the purposes of today's show. And much like The Natural, my opinion has softened some. I did think it was better in a second viewing, and I think part of the reason was because of my expectations. I didn't have quite the same expectation of baseball action that I wanted when I saw it the first time. This time around, I watched it with a different eye, and I saw it more as a kind of a descriptor of what it is like to be a baseball player, not what it's like to compete in a game, even though the game is the backdrop of the movie, but more of what that life is like, especially when you get to the end game. So I did, like I said, my opinion has softened some. I have not actually determined my rating yet. So it's going to be up to you guys to influence me one way or the other and see where I go with this. Sean, what is your history with this film?
This is my first viewing. It was, which is unusual for me. Actually, this type of movie is a movie I tend to gravitate towards. I like sports movies. I've heard good things about this one. So, and the cast, you know, it's got a stacked cast. So everything on paper is something I should have seen. Don't have a good reason why I didn't see it before now. I was excited when you threw out that this was going to be the one we were going to be doing. This is going to be the opportunity to see it. So I'd be interested to talk about the different lanes that this film talks about with the life of the baseball player, because of the fact that there's the lane of him as the baseball player trying to resolve that with trying to have a life outside of being a baseball player and having those merge in all the crazy ways that they do. So this is going to be a fun one to talk about.
Jeff, what is your history?
Well, I saw it the week it came out at the theater. I think it is one of my favorite baseball movies, given where you and I have been lately in the James Bond reviews. This will be me like a movie that you don't like. It's sort of the opposite roles there, which is great. I did rewatch it and partially listen to it yesterday, which is one of the things I want to talk about. And I think that there's a lot of layers to this movie. I think it is aging incredibly well, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what everybody thinks about some of the various elements.
Okay. Now, John and Maggie, I don't know if you are of a single mind on this. I don't know if you saw it together initially, so you tell us your initial impressions in whatever order you choose.
Well, I would have been 9 or 10 when it came out.
Please don't ever do that to me.
Every time.
Depending on what time of year it came out, I would have been a young kiddo. I don't remember the first. I saw it with you. You showed it to me
right.
A long time ago.
Yeah. I saw it first, actually. Well, I was on a Sam Raimi kick. Or some friends of mine were, and they were like wanted to be filmmakers, and so they were going through all Evil Dead and things and working through, and saw this one in the middle of that. And like much like Sean, I think, was saying, this is the kind of movie I probably should have jumped right on at the time because of the very same reasons he said. Plus, I really like, you know, Kevin Costner plus baseball, you know.
It's like Tom Cruise in Running.
Or, yeah.
Makes a good movie.
There you go. Mm-hmm. You mean all Tom Cruise movies?
If he's running, it's probably a good movie.
All right.
Tom Cruise movie where he's running, he's a young cocky guy and gets the girl in the end. I think that's a great formula.
Exactly. So I wound up really liking it. I was watching it at first in terms of Sam Raimi's kind of, it was part of his development from cult director into mainstream director, and there's some very interesting things in that. But in terms of baseball movies, this is my favorite baseball movie. I don't think it's the greatest baseball movie of all time, but it is the one that it is my comfort place. Every year, if I'm watching baseball movies, whichever ones I mix in, this one is always going to be watched. If I don't watch any of the other Kevin Costners, it's going to be this one. It's just always been a part. And I think you probably saw it, just when we were watching baseball movies once?
It had to have been at least 10 years ago.
Yeah, probably.
But then, like, I've seen it several times since, because we do tend to watch it for baseball times.
Now, I mean, as you mentioned, this is the combination of Kevin Costner and baseball movies. So this is the third Kevin in the Kevin Costner baseball trilogy. After Bull Durham and what's that other one?
That's the one with God in it.
This one with God in it.
Where he does which is another one.
That was the natural.
But it's another one that isn't really a baseball movie at its core, and that's my favorite. So it kind of eliminates my criticism to some extent that this one is more of a love story and a life story than it is a baseball story. You know, for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, the movie consists of flashbacks to Kevin Costner, who is, I've already forgot his character's name,
Billy Chappell.
Yeah. He's pitching basically his last game in the major leagues against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, and he's pitching a perfect game. So we flash to him during the game, and then we have flashbacks to, I guess it would be the last 5 years before this, because the first flashback says 5 years earlier. He's a 40-year-old pitcher, and the team that he's pitching for was recently sold, the Detroit Tigers, was recently sold, and the owner, who has a father-son relationship with Billy, is telling him, you know, he's going to be traded and he's got to figure out what he's going to do. And Billy doesn't know what he's going to do, you know, 40 years old. While 40 years old is young in life, it is very old in baseball or in professional sports. So I understand that when people get to that age, there is a level of confusion in your life as to what you need to do. If you aren't a natural coach or broadcaster, you're going to step right into another profession. And you can use your, you know, your competitive spirit to try and excel at that. If you don't have that, I could understand where life becomes very troublesome to these people when all of a sudden what they've known since Little League is gone. So that is the undercurrent of this movie. And again, I think it was well played in this movie, but it wasn't what I was looking for the first time I saw it. I was looking for a baseball movie. Basically, I was looking for a serious version of Bull Durham, you know, or Major League, rather. You know, something where, you know, they were competing, they were the underdogs, and they were going to come back and be that lovable team that beat off the big, bad New York Yankees. I think that's what I was looking for, and I didn't get that. I got more of a much more adult story than that. And by adult, I just mean sophisticated, not porn.
That would be a different movie.
Yeah.
It would be a very different movie.
Like, did you watch some extras? I didn't. I'm like...
Needed scenes, man. Needed scenes
are really bad. The alternate versions of the signs she hold up. It's like beyond this.
You know, I say it joking around, but sometimes when you say an adult movie, you know, that is the connotation. Yeah. So, you know, it often happens when we're reviewing comics and I say, oh, this is a more sophisticated adult comic. And, you know, I'm concerned that that is being interpreted as, oh, there's things in here a child shouldn't see. There's nothing in this movie a child shouldn't see. It is more just that the concepts that are presented are probably too sophisticated for a child to really accept them and understand them. So maybe in 1999, despite the fact that I was of... I was already a father once over, actually, at that point. You know, I didn't view it with that more sophisticated eye. I was looking at it more, you know, as a baseball movie. Maybe now, you know, at the point my career is at and life is at, I see things a little bit differently than I did then.
I think one of the keys to this movie is Kevin Costner. And I mean, I know that's a weird thing to say. I mean, it's the lead actor, of course. But in this story, one of the things that really works for him is they drop us into, hey, life is kind of over because this team has been his life. And we know he's at the later stages, the twilight of his career. So to go to another town to try and start over again and to establish a legacy there, he's not going there for that purpose. He's going there because this chapter's done. And it's, does he want to remain in the game when this chapter is clearly over? So they drop us in that piece. But the flashbacks and where they really worked for me is I've got to care because it's a very personal story. So I get, Paul, where if you're walking in thinking like this is going to be about the whole team and, you know, their rally and kind of what you mentioned, Major League. Major League is much more about a larger team. This one is very personal to this particular player. And the thing that I really loved about the flashbacks was getting to care about him, flaws and all, because he's not a perfect human being. And but that's real, right? You know, what you don't want is this guy that, like, now he's on this pedestal and you can't relate at all. What I really liked about the flashbacks is they made this man relatable. I wanted to hang out with him. There were times where I wanted to scold him, but not in a I hate him kind of way. He's becoming a friend. And it was something I thought the film established pretty early, is some endearing qualities about this man that I found myself by the end of the movie caring about him and feeling vulnerabilities throughout where this film goes. Because at the end, even though you feel like you know exactly where this is going to go as the game's playing, I loved that I did not feel it was a lock. There was multiple things that they did along the way that made me say, are they going to go this way with it? Are they going to go that way? I hope they don't. It went where I wanted it to go, but I loved that I didn't feel that it was a shoo-in. And it's because I cared about this man's journey that it was a roller coaster throughout that just felt so real. And I felt like by the end of the film, for the 2 hours and 15 minutes, this guy became a friend. And it was the coolest way. We all like that with sports heroes and things like that, that you want this intimacy with them, this chance to feel like you know them. And it's something that I thought the film accomplished very, very well. And this was, it's a very charismatic Kevin Costner, I thought, in this one.
I think that when you know how a film is going to turn out, or you think you know how a film is going to turn out, mm-hmm. both of these, and the film pulls you along anyway, mm-hmm. That's a little bit of magic. I'm well old enough that I remember, I mean, literally, I remember praying for the guys on Apollo 13. I'm was 6 or 7, and I remember that. And yet, when I see Apollo 13, I'm still on the edge of my seat. Okay, I know how this turns out, and it still grabs me. And I was thinking about this yesterday as I was rewatching the movie, and I say, you know, there's no paint by numbers in this, but you know the overall arc of the film where you want it to end up. And yet how it gets there, and I think it's the character moments you were talking about, Sean, about Costner's character, Billy Chappell, that pull you along through that, the relatively human level of the interaction between him and Kelly Preston's character trying to navigate life. And you see the human mistakes they make, and neither of them making them bad people. And yet it causes you to emote in, oh, I wish they would do this. You know, I'm blown away by that in this movie, and that has gotten better for me. And I liked it the first time I saw it, but over the years of rewatching it, that's what I think.
Now, one of the interesting aspects to this that I thought was, and I've gone on the record saying, I don't like when filmmakers give you an ambiguous ending and say, well, you have to determine what happened. I hate that in general. This gives us some ambiguity at the end, but it doesn't do so in that way. Because clearly, the way this develops as they show his life, Billy Chappell, his life has been baseball for the last 20-odd years. And he, you know, when this, I mean, there's some flashbacks to like the Tigers winning the World Series in 1984 with him on the team and things like that. So there are moments that go earlier. But the movie really is focused on that 5-year period from when his character met Kelly Preston's character to the day where he's throwing this no-hitter, or this perfect game, rather. at the point when we start with him, 35 years old, he's been in the major leagues, I guess, probably about 15 years. He's still not quite out of his prime. He's, you know, he's probably on the tail end of it, but he's still a star. And you see his life has been baseball, and he's had some dalliances, but he has no serious relationship. He spends this 5 years with her, and their relationship has ebbs and flows where they're very close and where they're not so close and where they're doing all sorts of things. Now, the movie is at the end point of his career, and he's got to make a determination. Am I going to accept a trade to another team at 40 years old, start my life over that way? Or am I going to go to London and start my life over that way? He ends up making the later choice, and the movie ends with a "and they lived happily ever after" type moment. But the reality of it is, if you sit and you think about all the subtext and everything that went on, you don't know. They could go to London and he could be absolutely miserable and say, "I'm heading back to the States, that's it." Or they could live happily ever after. So there is a little bit of an element of you have to figure out where this movie goes if you want to do that. But it isn't all, you know, it still ends on a happy note, but there's still ambiguity as to what the future holds. And I kind of like the way that was presented here.
If I could just toss my librarian hat on for a second with that. Just what we're seeing here is the structure of the movie is textbook romance. It goes through every single thing you expect in a romance novel, romance movie. You've got your meet cute, you've got your falling for, you've got your realizations that you're of the real people, the moment of crisis followed by the happily ever after, which is presumed to last forever. There's always going to be ambiguity because all romance stories are kind of both your romance and no romance at the same thing. So they all have to end and they lived happily ever after. There can be relationship dramas that end with a breakup, but that's not a romance, which this is. And it works. The structure follows both in the relationship story and in the baseball story too.
The one other piece, when you were mentioning the choices and the options for their future, I really liked that what was on the table was, would she want him to go to London with her?
Right.
And yeah, I thought that was a really cool element of this whole thing that added another layer, because of the fact that this relationship had been so about he's got his career, she's got her career. Do they intersect? And they do at times. You can see why they would fall in love, what she brings to his life that he couldn't get otherwise, why he's mesmerized by her, why she's mesmerized by him. You know, there's also things where you're like, well, this shouldn't work, which is a very human piece as well to relationships when you're dealing with two different people. But I did like that, as I was talking about earlier, like, you know where the movie's going to go. You feel that, you know, as you're watching it. But I liked that when there was opportunities, would she even want him to go to London at this stage with everything that they've gone through? And I like that. I like that I felt that for him as you're rooting for him. And it was something that I think was well played in the two of them, because I mentioned how three-dimensional he was. I thought she was too. And there's so much of her world that was fleshed out that I think it was two really well-developed parallel.
And I think that point is critical, because if she is not a three-dimensional character, if she's just a cipher who's going along with whatever he says, or, you know, just really doesn't have the feel of being real, then I think this movie loses a lot.
There's that sequence where she and Heather are like asking him all these questions. He's like, what are you asking me all these questions for? And she says, because I want to get to know you. And that kind of showed to me that she had a level of emotional maturity that he didn't have at that point, and that she had a more realistic, a more adult kind of interest in him than he had. I don't think that he was just in it for the sex. Like, no. I'm not saying that, but his first true love was still baseball.
Yes.
And he wasn't all that keen. Like, I guess the implication is that he would have been asking questions back to get to know her, but we're not shown that. We're only shown this kind of one-sided conversation where she's just asking all these random questions.
Yeah. Initially, because then we get to the point where he meets her daughter and he becomes part of the family with them.
Yeah, that's very true.
So it does develop beyond that eventually.
It takes him a minute, but yeah, he gets there.
But I love that where he gets to the point, he just goes, and he's in the middle of the night, he's sitting in the kitchen, he says, no questions.
Yeah.
I have been there. I just love that.
He's so messed up, he's eating bread thrown into milk.
What was that? Does anybody know why he was drinking milk with bread in it? Is that a thing? I don't know why he was doing that.
I think it was odd. One of the things I really like about this movie in terms of the character building, now this is on the Billy Chappell character, is that it's not dwelling in the past, but those elements of baseball with his dad, and those couldn't total 2 minutes in this movie. All of them run end to end, couldn't total 2 minutes. But they're vital to his statement that he's a baseball player, you know, and as we've already mentioned, you know, this probably goes back to Little League. So we're not talking about just a 20-year professional career. We're talking about if he's 40, this is a minimum of 30 years of his life.
Right.
There's a great line in Mr. Baseball where he says, even before I was a ball player, I was a ball player. And that sort of resonates in any ball player, any long-lived ball player's life. And I thought they did a really great job with it. And like I said, in very little time. And I think that informed the character really greatly.
Well, it's kind of the underarching theme of the entire movie is about family in all ways. It's not, yeah. And I think it's rather clever because it's not overtly spelled out, you know, throughout it. The father and son aspect is obvious. By the way, those were Kevin Costner's parents. That he looks up and the ghosts of them. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of cool. But I like, it's about a metaphor. There's two stories going on. He's kind of reaching a point in his life. Baseball not only has been his true love, it's been his family. I think Paul mentioned this earlier. The coach is his father figure, but we've got more than that. Gus is his wife figure. He's got a father-son relationship with the one player who, you know, has the ball bounces off of his head, and he, you know, gives him very paternal advice. His other friend that he has who winds up getting traded to the Yankees, he's moping around and talking. He's like a brother with him. So these are all surrogate family things, which he's learned how to do. But in terms of actually going out and living in the world, he hasn't done that. He's never had to do that. He's been a baseball player since he was a child. He's been getting in the headlines since Little League. He's not regular. Now he's suddenly in a situation where he wants to try to be a regular person to figure out how to fall in love. And he does not know where to start with this. On the other end, you've got Jane, who it's the line that said, is that her name? Mm-hmm. Jane?
Yeah, Jane.
The line was said about how Heather said she never had a romance. And I think in the beginning of the relationship, from her perspective, she was treating it more like just a fairy tale thing. Look at all of this glitz and glamour I get to be with a ball player. And, you know, it was kind of falling into that. And so they were both kind of going at it in the beginning with no real idea. They were trying to pretend it was more casual than it was and all of these things. And a big part of the flashbacks things was showing how they were untangling that mess. And I think at the part Maggie was talking about where they're, you know, on the, you know, going through the vacation and talking, you see that over time they've been asking these questions and all of that stuff. And that's where it's starting to get serious, and then they have, that's the crisis point, they have to decide, are we going to go forward to this and be mature, or are we going to leave it because it hit a point where it needs to change, just like his career in baseball right now.
I would like to point out too with the family thing, with when he refers to Gus as his wife, that's mm-hmm. within the first scene of the movie when he's still mm-hmm. very much in his arrested development. Mm-hmm. It shows that his idea of what a wife is someone who nags. Which is a term that I really, really dislike. Helpful because nagging is exclusively used when we're talking about women. But he has this very immature idea of what a wife is. He has a very immature idea of what most things are at the beginning of the movie. And the movie then follows his journey into becoming an actual adult human being.
Well, up until he meets Jane, the most serious relationship that they show us that he has with a woman is his masseuse.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Who he, like, who he has, you know, he gets his massages. He has an occasional dalliance with her. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. What? One of the things I will say about him, though, with the relationship, and it's one of the things that I liked, you saw the spark, and he never let it go. Like, yeah, throughout right. the film. It was something that I thought was really, really important. The rules for their relationship, he didn't establish them. She did. Because she thought that's what he wanted out of the relationship. And it's right. it's her putting walls up to protect herself because she's been hurt before. You know, in those pieces, but I thought it was something that was done really well. We didn't know yet at that point in time the other secret that she was keeping, Heather, you know, as far as those pieces go, which added a whole other layer to the whole thing. But he is the one, as far as trying to open doors, he's got this separate world of baseball and what that life looks like. And it's really the world that she thinks he doesn't want her to be a part of. You know, what that whole looks like. But he is the one that's reaching out and saying, hey, why don't you come down here? Why don't you be a part of this? It'll be fun. And she's putting the fence on because she thinks that's what she needs to do. Not only because that's what he wants, but she's trying to establish ground rules that protect herself from the what's already inside her. You can tell with the two of them, they're smitten with each other right away. And there's not that power struggle as far as which one is more in love with the other or anything like that. These are two kids that you're looking at and going, they get it. They want each other. There's a romance there and they just need to have a real talk.
the part to go what you're saying, Sean, like where she, you remember the second time she uses the word groupie and he gets mad about that. And I really like that. That's about them trying to define themselves with each other. And like you said, her trying to protect herself, you know, she's trying to use a, you know, put the brakes on and it comes from a place of cynical experience, you know, so that's really good.
And I think that's the part of having a relationship with two people in their mid 30s, as opposed to, you know, 20 somethings.
Yeah.
You know, you're dealing with people with life's experience, not necessarily, again, you know, the Billy Chappell character does have a level of arrested development, but he's still been through whatever he's been through to this point. And he's not, you know, just getting into college and, you know, finding somebody. This is somebody who's been through a lot in life already. So that there is that element of it. Now, changing or switching gears a little bit here, because it's just the one aspect of this movie that even when I didn't like it 26 years ago, even then, there was one aspect of the movie that I related to and really have just called upon for years and years and years. In my professional career, I've had to make presentations. I have to do things in front of people, stand up and talk. And it can be a little intimidating at times. And I know there are people, I've had coworkers where they've said, you know, oh, can I come in and watch you as you do this? And they'll say, no, no, no. You know, they get nervous. They don't want anybody watching them. In my career, I've had not quite as dramatically portrayed as they do it here, but I've had the ability to focus on what I was doing the way he does when he's getting ready to throw a pitch, where everything else stops existing. And it's just me and the people I'm speaking to, and that is it. Yes. And I could really relate to that, the way everything just kind of goes silent and he's just doing what he's doing. And from a sports point of view, I can't say I ever had that when I played baseball. But I did have a similar thing when I used to play darts, which I used to do frequently, where I could focus on the bullseye and in my mind almost create a spiral that went right to that bullseye and just try and throw the dart in that spiral. Now, I wasn't always successful, but it was kind of a state of mind, of focus, that I could relate to from what I saw here. And again, for 26 years now, I've always called upon that when I think of these things. And that I thought was a really key thing. And I think anybody who's been involved in, not necessarily athletics, but something where you really needed to be focused, could probably relate to that actual procedure, if not in the way he does it, because that's presented in the Sam Raimi dramatic way where all of a sudden everything just goes and it's silent. But I thought that was very relatable.
That I would get that in throwing free throws back in the day. I could get that. It's that flow state, I think they're calling it. If you can tag on that, how about the sound editing in this movie? Just, I think Tex might have something to say about that. He was talking about with that clear the mechanism thing, it was how it just, everything fades back, is still there, but all you could hear just is that perfect sound of leather hitting leather. Just the iconic sound of a pitch hitting a glove. And that just charges me and I'm right there. I've seen this movie a million times, and when that happens, I am in this game. I want to know what's going to happen, even though I know.
Yeah, I think that's phenomenal. I often say that almost never do we talk about sound editing in a positive light. People do not walk out of the movie theater thinking, oh, the sound in that movie was great. Dunkirk was an exception. And there's a handful of others where I've actually heard people talking about the sound, and that sound of when he says clear the mechanism, the sound drops out almost entirely. And like, if you're listening to the movie quietly, it does drop out entirely. If you're listening to it at a good level, there's still a muffled sound there. And then the ball hitting the catcher's mitt. Man, there's so many things, and this is where I will plead that there are moments that are impossible for me to separate from my own nostalgia, my own experience, and the sound of the baseball hitting a glove or a mitt is right up there. The other ones I mentioned earlier were the quick flashbacks with his dad just throw the ball, and I just. That kind of stuff. And also, I got to say, I think that's really astute, given that we've had a great Costner movie about baseball that was really about a relationship with a dad. I think that pulling that along was really smart in the way they did this. I've never read the book the movie is based on, so I don't know. I don't know if that's an element in the book or not, but. But it's a phenomenal thing that they use really well. And one more thing I wanted to throw back earlier when we were talking about the Ersatz family aspects of baseball is the power of the owner saying he'll look out for him like a son when he told Billy Chappell's dad. My grandmother was in her 80s before she started watching hockey. when the Penguins drafted Sidney Crosby. He lived with Mario Lemieux's family. And that's what got my grandmother.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
And you know, she would say, I hope they put that ball in the net. for the last 15 years of her life, she watched hockey because of that family dynamic. And I think that's was my first clue that's a very powerful thing to other people.
You just made me think of something with that. It's like this movie is kind of like it explore in a way, bits of it are exploring the same themes that the other two Kevin Costner movies did. Fathers and sons and the need to grow up and get past your situation in baseball. But it's actually done. I don't want to say smarter, more mature is even not quite what I'm talking about. It's like where Bull Durham ends with his character realizing that he needs to grow up and move on. He hasn't completely left it. He's still he hasn't made any real emotional changes you've seen, and he's still going to be involved in baseball. In Field of Dreams, you know it's about the relationship with the father and son is big because we've been told this and we've been seeing all these things, but we don't really get the sense of what it was that he gave him. In this movie, just that scene, just throw the ball, just play catch, that just encapsulates entirely every single thing, especially when they show it at the end when he's struggling like that.
Yeah.
It's there. It really just hits all of those things in a different, possibly more mature way.
I definitely agree. Now, I am grateful for the writer of this story for not making the relationship with his father a father issue. They're presenting it as a positive relationship. His father imbued into him the love of the sport and the ability to focus and do that. And his memories of his father are fond. And I find that so much more relatable. Thankfully, I went through life without father issues. And I, you know, I look back on my relationship with my dad and I can't really point to negatives. So many of the movies fall back on the cliche of the deadbeat dad or the father mm-hmm. that passed away when you needed him, you know, not even necessarily a bad dad, but a dad that just wasn't there. And that has become very cliche over the years. And it's often done to good effect, but in this way, he's looking back on that as one of the positives of his life and one of the motivating factors. I find that to be just so much more fulfilling watching the movie. So I really appreciated that in it. The other thing I really appreciated is Kevin Costner's attention to detail. Now, Kevin Costner, I do believe he played college sports.
In college a little bit, yeah.
But I assume he was not quite talented enough to be a professional athlete. And just the same, though, when he's done these movies, he looks like an athlete, and I don't think that's by accident. I think he works hard. In this instance, they said he worked with Dave Island, who I know used to be on the Yankees at one time, who was a pitcher. And they worked together extensively so that when he would make his motion on the mound, he looked like a professional baseball player. He didn't look like, you know, William Bendix playing Babe Ruth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had really good form, especially in that slow motion pitch shot. That could have been just an actual pitcher.
Yeah, but... like Kevin Costner, as opposed to Charlie Sheen, has no. Just I mean, they both did a really good job. Yeah, with their pitching. Bob Uecker said so himself. Bob has since passed. But see, now I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, there's a kind of like a natural fluidity. Like Kevin Costner really knows what he was doing. Like he's been doing it for a long time. I think Charlie Sheen did a very good job, but he had a coach that showed him how to do it. And when Kevin does it, there's just something. When he's in a baseball movie, you can feel his love for baseball in his performance and in how he goes about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty cool. I
think that's a good point. I think that's a real good point. And I think Costner, we can make I'm sure there's exceptions that we could point to, but he tends to inhabit a role that's broader than his baseball movies. He tends to be believable as the characters. I'm sure there's exceptions we could drill down on and say it wasn't true, but he tends to inhabit characters in the physicality of them. And I think that really came through here.
The cliche that they avoided that I really liked too was that the game itself was not for them to be the winners of the championship. It was not going to change the station of now all of a sudden the team's going to be saved. They're not going to be sold or he's going to end up staying with the team. It was a very real journey of a man who he's at a transition point in his life, does not know what he wants from it. And we get to see him go on that journey during the game of kind of coming to closure, which so many people don't get. I mean, we've all been at transitions in our lives, large and small, where sometimes there are ones that we're able to be more in the driver's seat. Other times you don't get closure. You don't have that opportunity. This is something that, yes, has been thrust on him. He doesn't have a choice to. But what he does have control of is how he is going to respond to it. And I love that it was awkward. I love that it was human. I love that where his mind was changed throughout the movie, throughout the game that he was playing. And we got to enjoy that like real time and see what that looked like. That's where it felt real. It wasn't like we knew at the start of the game how he felt, and we knew at the end of the game how he felt. It was, we were getting there with him along the way. When he signed that ball and did what he did, we didn't have to see what it said. You knew because of the fact that our whole journey with him was taking us there.
The weight of it on that time, Sean,
yeah.
You're right. And I think one of the things about that came from the structure of how they did the flashbacks. They wait till, you know, they wait till he sits down when the Tigers are up for him to start pondering this past stuff. And then it starts, you know, in the second inning, then it starts intruding on when he's on the mound.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the flashbacks. But they wait until the in baseball rhythm, they wait until the moment he sat down at the end of the Yankees first inning. And I thought it was a really effective use of that structure to pull us through all those emotions you just talked about.
Yeah, and I think baseball is a really good vehicle for that, especially when you're at the end of the season. It's so metaphorical. It's the end of the summer, for one thing. It's the end of the baseball season. And then in this, it's also kind of representative, I think, of the end of childhood. I think baseball, more than anything else, is really associated with, like, being a children's sport. Oh, yeah. I mean, we've got hockey movies and basketball movies and soccer movies, but baseball movies are in a thing of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just, I think part of it is because it's in the summer and summertime tends to make people happy and also nostalgic. Then when it, like at the very beginning of the movie, like when he meets her, she was going to take off. I don't know what she was going to do with her baby at the time, mm-hmm. but when he meets her, she's like taken off and she says, it's because summer is over and I missed it. You know, so baseball's just such a great way to tell stories of maturing, of family, of closure, of grief. And it's a very versatile storytelling sport. Who knew?
I want to add one other thing just about the structure with what's been saying. I really like it when a movie does the trick that this one does. And it's a lot, try it and it doesn't work. It's where you show you a scene out of context. And you're desperate in the beginning and you're really trying to figure out who these people are, what's going on. And you are manipulated into developing a certain opinion. When you see what's going on, that he's waiting for her to call and he's worried and she's not talking. And then their conversation that they have, you have no context. With just that in mind, you think she's terrible. Who is this person doing this to him on this last thing, not telling all of this? And it's awful. How could she do this to him in this way? Then later, when you see it have gone through all of that, especially at the spot you're in, like right after the last time they'd seen each other was at the art gallery and it had done all this, and you realize where they were right before they were going through it, it adds so much more to it. He's desperate because he thought that this was the chance he was going to be able to, you know, rekindle something. I don't know if he had given it the mature level of thought that he needed the flashbacks to do, you know, eventually, but he was still there. He was expecting something. It didn't happen. And now he doesn't.
It's personal growth through introspection.
Hey,
you know, like it takes him getting on the mound and pitching a perfect game while really hungover to do it. But it's through use of the flashbacks and thinking back on his relationship with Jane and everything that happened and understanding, I think, why she didn't show up when he was expecting her to, because he tells the guy at the hotel, like, everything has to be perfect. Right. So he's got the flowers, he's got the champagne, he's got the fancy food, and she doesn't show up because that's not what love is. Love isn't romantic dinners. Love is work. Love is hard, you know, and I think she was more aware of that at the time than he was, but he figures it out.
I think that something, Maggie, you said about what she was doing with her baby at the time. I actually finally resolved that yesterday. By listening to dialogue. There's just one line, and it's when Heather, the daughter, when he goes and rescues her from being abandoned at her dad's.
Yeah.
She says, whenever I see my dad, implying there's been.
Yeah. Oh yeah. She's probably with him.
And that's, yeah. And having been through a custody thing, I finally figured that out and made my peace with that yesterday. Cause okay. I always wondered the same thing.
It's there's no baby in that car.
She wouldn't have been a baby then.
She would have been 9 or 10, whatever. Kid.
It's actually one of the things I do like about Jane's life, and I think it's where they can relate to each other. And you could actually see them having a successful future together. She has her own lanes too. you know, mm-hmm. we keep talking about his with baseball and that's his life over here, and then trying to have a life with Jane over here and resolving how they come together. For her, it's her daughter, and to a certain extent, her art. But her daughter is kind of that piece that she's left that separately. And her time interacting with him is when her daughter's elsewhere. Because mm-hmm. that's like her other lane, her almost, we all need that, right? In anything, you know, if you're well-rounded, you have other lanes that, you know, kind of help you just escape from being too overly involved in some aspects of your life. And with Jane, mm-hmm. it is that time when her daughter's with the dad. Not every parent has that opportunity when divorces happen and things yeah. like that. That doesn't always, in this case, we know with this story that the dad is involved to some level. Not highly thought of. If there's a deadbeat dad in this one, I'm pretty sure it's Heather's. Yeah. Just, at least from the impression that I'm getting from Heather's storytelling with it. But you know, that's, I don't need that to go any further than it did. But it was interesting to, and I think you needed that because you wanted to see her bond with Kevin Costner. So, you know, that part of it was, I thought, very interesting with the two of them as we were going through. But I thought for Jane, I see how she can relate to him because she's had to have, don't come into this world. This world's separate. This world's my protected world. This world's my thing. And I do think that's where she understands him to a certain extent.
Yep. I think you hit on, again, another big part of the theme of this movie in two ways. It's like how you need other people even while you're doing something on your own.
Yes.
And it's summed up by Gus's great Oscar nomination speech that he gives, which I get a lump in my throat and a chill every time when he's like, no, you just throw the ball. The guys are here for you. We're going to be awesome for you because we don't stink so much right now. We are the best team in baseball right now because it's a perfect game. The pitcher gets the credit for it. But there has never been a perfect game in the history of baseball that didn't involve at least one massive one player going above and beyond that to a level he would not have in a normal game to make an incredible play. He needed you. The perfect game is so rare. So many things have to go right. So many things are out of the control of the pitcher. But all of them came together to rally around him to give him the achievement.
I love that. I love that aspect, John. One of the things that it always harkens back to me for is, you know, he's hungover. He's hungover. He's emotionally deflated and all that. And he's 40. And I always think back to Nolan Ryan's seventh no hitter. He told Tom House, my back is really bad. You better be prepared to come get me early. Tom House for the Rangers. And
well, that's something, yeah, that I think is total reality in baseball is, you know, hearing interviews with pitchers, there are so many games where they didn't pitch well, but they say, you know, in the bullpen session before the game, I felt like everything was on the money, and then vice versa, where, you know, they say, you know, I was having trouble getting control of the ball, and I, you know, I had to rely on my number two and number three pitch, and then they ended up pitching an awesome game. So it shows you the variables, and I think the film does a good job, as John was talking about, of showing you how precarious a perfect game is and how, you know, just one play, you know, one ball could just slip through and that's it. The game is, you know, the perfect game is gone. And they're, you know, they're showing that, and then they have the manager, you know, he has the question of whether or not he's going to get anybody up in the bullpen, because they're really only winning this game 1-0. It's not like it's, you know, it's not like they're kicking butt and he doesn't have to worry about winning the game because he's so dominant. So the whole thing is kind of like sitting on, you know, teetering on the edge and could fall over at any time.
And another Nolan Ryan analogy, when he's facing his former teammate Davis Birch, and he drops in a changeup. Yeah. You know, late in Ryan's career, he could still throw the fastball, but he added the circle change, and guys who had faced him, like, their whole careers couldn't hit it.
Right.
And so see a guy and it's like one line. It's not even, they don't even dwell on it, but that this experienced player has added a pitch, which is what a savvy pitcher that's lasted long would do. Mm-hmm. That was a really cool element to me.
You got to have as many tools in your tool belt as you can. Yeah. Isn't there, am I incorrect in thinking that somebody pitched a perfect game tripping on acid?
No hitter.
It was a no hitter.
That was, okay.
Doc Ellis.
Doc Ellis for the Pirates.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
It's okay. Jeff's team.
I wasn't perfect. That would have been insane. Yeah. That's already pretty insane to begin with. It was like
the least perfect no hitter ever. He had so many walks in that game. But I really like what you just said with that, because that's kind of, it's bookended in the lines in the beginning, and then they come back at the end and remind us of it. But she's saying you can win the game all by yourself. You're perfect. Yeah. And comes back at the end when you realize both, no, it's not all by himself. And she realizes, no, I can't do this life all by myself. This person needs to be in his life.
And it should have been like best night of his life. And it meant
that's heartbreaking too. Where he's crying on that always really gets me.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to focus on the individual performances so much, unless you guys have something you want to point out. But I thought the performances in this film were pretty much universally on the money. I don't know if I'm going to give credit to that to just each individual actor and actress, or if it's Sam Raimi pulling the performance out of people. So that I can't really say. But I thought everybody hit the right notes. I have, in the last 20 years, come to see John Reilly as a kind of more of a comical character than a serious actor. But he mm-hmm. plays his part so well. He does seem that there does feel, you do feel that connection between him and Billy Chappell. And you feel, you know, there's a best friend chemistry between them. So there's so much going on with all of the smaller supporting parts, but I think they all really just hit the money.
Jenna Malone as Heather Aubrey mm-hmm. in this one it's a great cast across the board. So I just want to say that, but that role is pretty critical because there are sequences with her. Like there's one point in time during the game where they flash to her and she's tearing up mm-hmm. and it felt like so good. And it's not as an isolated scene. It's everything surrounding it with her that made that scene mean something more. I believed at this point in time, they encountered each other at the college, you know, at that point in time. And that felt real. It felt like she wanted to like this person, I want this person more ingrained in my life. This is a dad figure, you know, stepfather, whatever you want to call it, you know, you just feel like that relationship is part of her parental unit and she wants him in that life. And no matter what happens with the relationship with her, with the mother, that relationship is solid. And if they encounter each other 10 years later and the two don't get back together, she's still going to feel that way about him because he's had a pivotal mark on her life.
Critical to Billy's growth.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes. And I just, her casting and the way that she played that part, I thought was every bit as fully realized as I thought both of our two main leads were. And it was really an important part of this. And you don't always see that sometimes with a kid. Mm-hmm. They're meant to be like a cute aspect. And you get that endearing quality as far as why there's a connection, but you don't get that. Like, she's not a perfect kid either. And I actually really liked that she has a similar like story mm-hmm. arc to what they've got, in the sense that we get to see her growth as a character too.
I totally bought it too. They were really, really well acted, good chemistry between them. Yeah.
But without her character, then Billy and Jane's relationship, I think, stalls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But with her there, I think she is the impetus for them to develop that family relationship that then, you know, does go fade away. And then it's, you know, it's still there, but it's not. And it, you know, eventually leads to them realizing, at least, you know, if you want to go with the happily ever after ending, that they belong together.
I think you guys have all just made excellent points about this. I do want to drop in one character call out, because for me it's the glue of the movie. And this gets back to what I said earlier about you know, we can't, for baseball and me, I can't separate nostalgia from it. I don't even try and pretend to. It's Vin Scully.
I mean,
whether Vin was rewriting his own dialogue to make it sound like him, or the writer did that, if the writer did that, God bless, it's freaking great. I did it yesterday. I'm doing it right now. Got misty eyed thinking about missing Vin Scully. There's an episode in the second season of Bosch Legacy called "I Miss Vin Scully," and there was no greater poet of the game than Vin Scully. I grew up with Bob Prince in Pittsburgh. I listened to Ernie Harwell out of Detroit. I listened to Harry Carey in Chicago, and Mark Holtz with the Texas Rangers, and John Sterling with the Yankees. And some of these guys are just really great, great baseball announcers, but they're regional. And yeah, part of the Dodger experience is absolutely was Vin Scully, but he also did it on the national stage, and it was just the love of the game. I mean, the guy starts with the Dodgers the year before they leave Brooklyn and sticks with him till like less than a year and a half before he passes away, I think. And it just the fluidity of and the naturalness of him sounding like him doing a game, a critical game. And when you get to that crescendo of, you know, the cathedral that is Yankee Stadium belongs to the chapel. I mentioned this when we started, that part of what I did yesterday was listening to this. I actually went in the kitchen and was washing dishes. And I was just listening to him call a couple of those scenes. And it was just like listening to a Dodgers game for me, or a game of the week that he did. And I realized how much I missed that.
I totally agree with you.
Having just watched Bob Uecker and Aaron, really hit me this time. Because they were the last two in that era. Really.
My great grandmother listened to Bob Uecker. She was a huge baseball. Well, she was a Brewers fan. Her parents moved to Wisconsin from Germany. She was born here, but she was a first generation, and she loved her Packers and she loved her Brewers. And my mom would listen to Bob Uecker when I was like itty bitty baby me. They would play cribbage and listen to Bob call the games on the radio, and I'd be bouncing in my little kinkarockaroo thing. And, you know, baseball is, that's why I like it. It partly because of my relationship with John, and I wanted to get to know him better. He liked baseball, so I learned baseball. And it turns out I tend to know more about baseball during the season than John does now.
Yeah.
You know, I love this sport. I love baseball. And I like baseball movies, and I want to watch more of them.
It's funny because, I know we're going off topic a little bit, just a little bit. But, you know, I've had a love for Bob Uecker as an announcer with what little I've heard of him. I haven't lived in Milwaukee, so I haven't heard of him nearly as much. But even back in the 80s, I read his book, and I've always loved it. And I think he has had a reputation as, you know, just being a funny guy. But when you do listen to him call a game, he knows the sport backwards and forwards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he can add the humor into it. So that was, you know, he was one of the all-time greats. There's no question. I think Vin Scully was the all-time great. And
no question.
I don't think it's recency bias that he was lost not that long ago. I think just through the years, he proved himself to be the best orator of baseball, the feel of a baseball game that's ever been. And I would say, as a Mets fan, I have been blessed through most of my lifetime with some really, really good announcers. That's one aspect of this team that, you know, even though they've gone through the doldrums, that's always been pretty much top-notch. They've had one or two that didn't live up to it, but for the most part, I've had great announcers in my life, and Vin Scully is better than all of them.
Yeah, I gotta agree, Paul. There wasn't any chance that I was gonna listen to a lot of Yankee games when I came up here. The holy moment in my dad's life was Game 7 in 1960 when Maz hit the home run to beat the Yankees, and my dad wore both his emotions and his faith on his sleeve, and yet he giggled like a little girl when you told him that the Yankees cried after they lost to the Pirates. But the by and large, the Mets announcing team, particularly on radio, is really among the best, because they always know something interesting about the other team as well as what's going on with the Mets. They frame the thing in the storytelling that we grew up with baseball, and it makes it really powerful. And so I can say that as a non-Mets fan, that they're just to echo that and not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but that you are correct. Their broadcast teams have been great.
I like the TV people of the Mets a lot.
And just keeping the, keeping on the tangent a little bit, for my, I hate saying my age because I feel so old, but for my 60th birthday, my friends got me a cameo greeting from Howie Rose. And you know what I walked away from that, I still have it obviously, but I listened to that, and I've listened to it several times, and clearly he put the work into making the greeting that he did into his job. Like it never feels like he mailed it in. Mm-hmm. It feels like a personal greeting, and it's just wonderful. So I have a good friend of mine that produces the Mets radio. And he keeps saying, one game when I'm there, he's going to bring me in and introduce me to Howie Rose. So I look forward to that actually happening. But getting back to this, I don't think any of us would belittle in any way the performance of Vin Scully. And Steve Lyons does a nice job of the color commentator as well. So everything feels true the way they present it. The athletes look real. The emotions seem real. Everything about it is really done well. I do think we should talk about the music a little bit, because I thought this had an appropriate score where it really does emphasize moments and it does feel important at times. It never overshadows the movie, but it really does add to it, in my opinion. I don't know if any of you had any strong opinions on that.
I disagree with you slightly on that. I liked the score very much, but I did think it got a little bit too much at a couple of times. It was just like hitting the main theme crescendo like over and over and over again at the end, might have. But it was, as you said, appropriate, to the thing. And that's just me and my cranky pedantry.
I never know how to say it. Basil Poledaris, his last name. But my favorite score of his is Red Dawn, by far. Like, nothing's even really close to it. But this, I thought, is really good. I was listening to it again, with some detail in mind yesterday, and I really liked it. And there may be a spot or two where they revisit it a little too much, so I'd concede that. But I really like it, and I thought it added to the flavor.
Soundtrack was good too. Great use of songs. Paint It Black in particular,
I was thinking, like, the Paint It Black part was probably my favorite use of the
and sound. Bob Seger's Against the Wind used.
Yeah, that. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it blended the soundtrack with the score well. And I thought, that it and they felt meaningful when they added in songs. It didn't feel like they were just adding them in there for nostalgia or whatever. So I really liked that.
For me, the measuring stick of a good soundtrack for me is whether or not I even care about listening to it after the movie's over. Because there's somewhere, it's nothing wrong with it. It's just it served the movie and I'm happy to move on. I actually wanted to listen to this one afterwards, which I think says something in general. The fact that the music mattered to me.
So before we get to our ratings, any other points that anybody had about this one?
Two quick things. Just there were some great dialogue hits. I love the "God, I hate Yankees fans." is great. that Yankee fan in the bar of the airport was absolutely perfect. I've met that guy.
Again, casting and portrayal, absolutely freaking excellent.
Mm-hmm. Also, I liked the bit of Tuttle, the worst of the Yankees, that he actually was a jerk enough to try to lay down a bunt in the middle of a perfect game, which is kind of one of those unwritten rules that you don't do. But my absolute favorite part of this movie, and it's what brings me back every time and I get the biggest grin on my face, is in the moment where Billy goes out and he's standing there and suddenly he turns and looks at the scoreboard, you know, in the eighth inning or seventh inning or whichever, and then
zero, 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 zero.
Has anybody been on base? Nope. I absolutely love that. And then it just carries it through to the end.
Which just shows you how his character is locked into the moment.
Yeah.
He's not locked into the batter he faced before. He's locked into the guy who's up at bat right now. And he's not paying attention to what happened before, because that would cut out on his focus. And then when he is aware of what's going on, that's when he has trouble clearing the mechanism, because now he's seeing the magnitude of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just a great character moment. And I really hadn't even thought about it from that perspective until just now.
He is tapping into his life's journey, though. And that's the way he's also drowning out the noise. Like the sequences we're seeing are his memories. They aren't. It was an interesting way to use flashbacks during the game, was that you see him when he gets on the mound, you know he is having those reflections along the way. Because he references more than once during the game that he's blocking out the noise. He's not hearing the crowd. We actually hear it in the sound, in where, you know, when he gets on the mound, like all of a sudden everything gets muted. Yeah. And we see him go into that piece. I liked that they were using during the game flashbacks as a way of saying this is him reflecting. She was also similarly reflecting at certain points in time. And that part was, you could use the same flashback scenes as just being these isolated segments that were taking us back to their past. And I thought that worked really well, as that was a tool he was also using. So yes to everything we said before as far as what he was doing to focus on, and he didn't know what was going on with the score, but it was also, he was pulling inside different reflections, even the memory of his parents. Like, I thought that was so sweet and endearing when we got to see that piece. That was almost, I actually loved the cinematography on that, where it was almost like a black and white sequence, but it was almost like the perfect picture for him. Because it was obviously a snapshot moment of his life,
and they made it look older by decreasing the resolution of it.
Yes. Yeah. It just worked so well. So those flashbacks being things that he was tapping into as he was going through this journey of where his life goes from here, and how he feels about that, I think was something that was very intimate and worked really well for me.
And if I could just say one more thing quick, because just to tag on what Paul was saying, he made me think of this. There aren't too many movies, even there's movies about pitchers, but this is the only movie I can think of that really gets into pitching. And that's a tricky thing to do, because for the average fan, they don't really pay attention to the intricacy of what goes into the pitching and catching. They're looking for hits and home runs. This one really shows you what's going on in a pitcher's head and how they're like working through. I pitched a little bit back in high school. It's similar to the thing, just the idea of all you care about is this guy right now, you know, sort of not to the degree he did, because I'm not a good baseball player, but I really like that aspect.
It's funny. The Natural should start off from how it starts off, should be a pitching movie, but then, but then something goes horribly wrong.
So when you come down to it, when I saw this movie in 1999, I didn't care for it. I thought it was, I actually thought it was boring. And I thought it didn't give me enough baseball. And if I had the Jaws scale in 1999, I probably would have given this a low Jaws 3. Then I started to watch this and I thought, you know, yeah, this has got more to it. There's more meat to this movie than I thought. And the performances are better than I thought. And the subtext and everything that's going on, the analogies for life, everything in there is a little bit more. So, you know what? This might move itself up to about a low Jaws 2. And then we're talking about it, and we're going through all that subtext and going through the performances. And I have to say, I can't give it a Jaws, but it's a solid Jaws 2. It's so much better than I thought it was. And I have to give you credit for getting me to rewatch it, because I never would have. Mm. What do you guys say?
Then my work here is done.
Yeah. But I was fighting to give this a Jaws 2. And the reason being, I was trying to use as my excuse that I haven't watched it again yet. But I will say, 2-hour and 15-minute movie, when it ended, I just wanted to throw it back on again. I told my wife, we've got to watch this together. She hasn't seen it yet. This is a movie I will rewatch over and over and over again. I say that confidently, which is very hard to say when you've only seen the movie once. But it had all the right feels. I'm struggling to find, there's not a scene that I would remove. There's not something that I would plop in there that, like, I'm like, boy, they missed this opportunity. I wanted more, but that's just because I was enjoying it so much. So as far as pacing goes, it gave me everything I want from a movie. This is a Jaws for me. I would recommend it to people easily, just because of the characters. I could see myself watching this again and focusing on some other aspect of the relationship or some other aspect of a character and really enjoying exploring that more than I did this time around. So this is, I if I was going to give it a Jaws 2, I'm just doing it to, like, because I'm forcing it there. So it for me, it forces itself really to be a Jaws because of just how exciting this was. I'm glad we did this because I had not seen this before and had no idea I was going to have this kind of reaction from it. This was really a pure joy from start to finish over it.
I would say that, Paul, you've never heard me say this was a Jaws, and this was a Jaws. I love this movie. Everything about it, and like I know I've said it already twice, I'd make no pretense about separating my nostalgia. It's baseball. I can't do that. I'm not even trying. Relationship with my dad stuff. You know, my dad is the one who taught me about Vin Scully, and to me, that's the glue of this movie. You could have picked any other announcer, could have done a very serviceable, wonderful job, and we would be talking about it favorably. But the fact that I'm talking about it in glowing fashion, I think, comes down to that. But everybody in the movie's great. There's not, Sean, to your point, I don't think there's a wasted scene. I don't think there's one scene in this movie that's frivolous. And that's the economy of doing that and telling this story and it coming across and representing all of the characters. Maybe they don't get equal weight, but they all are well performed and given. Nobody's put upon as bad dialogue or anything else like that. It's a really solid movie. And I wholeheartedly recommend it to somebody that has any predisposition to baseball.
Oh, I'm going to agree with Paul. I think it's Jaws 2. I think overall it's a solid movie. I think it is a little bit dated. It's very much a 90s movie. I will also disagree just a teeny tiny bit. I really don't like Jenna Malone. I didn't like her in this, and I didn't like her in Pride and Prejudice. That's just a personal preference thing. I just don't like her all that much. That aside, that's a fairly minor point in comparison with the whole film. I just don't feel right saying it's Jaws, but I do feel right saying Jaws 2. And I think that's what we're going to go with. That's my justification. It feels right.
I was coming here completely prepared to give it a Jaws 2 because I somehow had it in my head that this couldn't possibly be a Jaws because this was not a well-received movie. It got several Razzies at the time. It's kind of like whenever people bring it up, people will say it's the worst of the three Kevin Costner movies. Is just kind of a standard thing. I know people didn't like it. Paul was talking before about how he didn't like it. So I was not expecting the conversation to go this way. I thought it was going to have to be me justifying things over and over again. But is this not America? Is baseball not America's favorite pastime? So this is Jaws. It's this, all of the talk here has made me realize that, yeah, there's all of the things that I wanted to, just to kind of do a parallel to Maggie's. It feels right. Any of the reasons I would want to give it a Jaws 2 just kind of fade away thinking about the conversations we had. So I guess my favorite baseball movie is the one I think is the best baseball movie. So eat it.
That's the great thing about opinions. They can be different. Everyone can be wrong and everyone can be right.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, opinions are like, well, you know what? You know how that goes.
Yeah, we know what opinions are.
So ubiquitous. Thanks for coming on, guys. This has been a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed seeing aspects of this movie that I might not have seen otherwise. So your presence here is very much appreciated. I hope the listeners enjoyed it as much. Thank you for everybody who did listen, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Clear the mechanism.